Well, good morning. It's good to be back with you. I'm Chris Mulheron, and I'm giving the second talk on science and faith matters. As you know, we're in the middle of a 10-week series thinking about creation and humanity. The series has biblical sermons alternating every second week with a talk from yours truly about how scientific understandings of the world intersect with a biblical and Christian worldview. You'll remember 2 weeks ago that I suggested three reasons why it's important for Christians to think at least a little about science and faith issues. Those reasons were, firstly, that we live in a world dominated by science and technology, and it's a world that is often antagonistic to Christian faith. So for the sake of connecting with people outside the church, it's really useful to have a basic understanding of what you might say to the person who says, "I believe in science," and who thinks that that is a good reason for not considering Christianity. Secondly, I suggested that building a robust faith and an integrated worldview means coming to grips with science. Many people use science as an excuse to leave faith behind. In fact, being at peace about the harmony between science and faith is not only possible, but it's positively enriching to our faith. The third reason why science is good news for Christians is that science is the way we uncover the amazing universe, the amazing works of the Creator. The heavens declare the glory of God, says the psalmist. I hope these reasons give you an incentive to think about these things, even if they take us to places, as they will this morning, that we might be uncomfortable with, or even places that or issues that are difficult to follow. So having looked at the general relationship between science and faith last time, today we tackle one of those issues that are a definite challenge for Christians. The question today is, do we as Christians have to choose between creation and biological evolution? I don't have to tell you that some people do say that the biblical view of life on this planet is simply in conflict with the picture that the biological sciences tell us. Let me be very clear at the outset that we're not going to resolve all the tension between biology and Bible. There are various positions that we might take on the matter, and there is no position that is a neat and tidy answer. So don't expect miracles today. As we wander into thinking about these things, don't worry if you don't follow every bit of what I say. That will be a good reason to buy a book that I'm going to recommend at the end. No, somebody else's book, although you might buy mine as well. Let's clarify the situation. The Bible describes God as responsible for the creation of everything. We've just heard two creation narratives this morning, one out of the first chapter of John, one out of the first chapter of Colossians. The Bible has more than 20 creation narratives in it, although we tend to think of Genesis 1 and 2 as the go-to place. God is responsible for everything, including all life on the planet. In this sense, all Christians are creationists. Christians believe that there are only two types of stuff in the world. There is God, and there is what God has made, the creation. All that is has its source in God one way or the other. We might say that God is the first cause of everything. So Christians believe that humans are deliberately created by God and created in God's image, totally different in some respects to the rest of the animals. So far, so good. Meanwhile, the big picture painted by mainstream biology is of the history of all life on Earth, going back to a single cell some 4 billion years ago. That cell even has a name, LUCA, which stands for Last Universal Common Ancestor. You and your cousins have a last common ancestor. Yes, your grandparents are also the grandparents of your cousins. So you and your cousins can both trace your family line back to those common ancestors. Now go back almost 4 billion years, and Luca is the ancestor of every life form on the planet today. And according to the overwhelming consensus of scientists, human beings are the result of a long process of gradual change that we call biological evolution. In the words of the title of a 1973 essay written by Christian and world-renowned scientist, biologist Theodosius Dobzhansky, "Nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution." Well, which of these views is correct? I won't repeat all the words I've just said, but if you think about it carefully and remember the things that we talked about 2 weeks ago, you might see that perhaps there's no necessary conflict between the two views on the slide. It is a false choice. How can both the Bible and biology be right? Let's recap a little of what you might remember from a couple of weeks ago. Remember the boiling water? Remember that there are two answers to the question about the cause of the water boiling? The primary cause of the boiling water is that someone wants a cup of tea. And the secondary cause is the mechanism or process that occurs in order to arrive at boiling water for a cup of tea. So both so-called explanations for the boiling water are correct. Imagine you walk into a Ferrari factory where robotic machines are building gleaming red cars with not a person in sight. What is the explanation for what is going on? Sure, you can talk about how the computer-controlled robots are assembling the vehicles. But that does not explain why the robots are there in the first place, or indeed why the factory is there in the first place. The primary cause of the car factory is in terms of its purpose and the conscious minds that brought it into existence. Perhaps it's about money. Perhaps it's about ego. Have you seen Ford versus Ferrari? If not, I highly recommend it. There is a meaning and purpose behind the car factory, but you won't find it by examining robots and computer software. So as we ponder the Bible and biology, keep in mind that biological evolution is the mechanism, like the car factory robots, while the Bible tells us about God's purposes and the meanings behind the processes of history. Let's first talk a little bit more about how we approach the biblical text, the text of Genesis, but also the text of the Bible in general. Then we'll touch very quickly on what biological evolution is about. We've already heard from Mike 3 weeks ago and from Renee last week, but let me reiterate some of the things they said and add a little more about interpreting the Bible. In the first place, we need to realise that the Bible was not written to answer the questions of 21st century scientifically oriented people. We modern Westerners are bound up with a culture that in many ways is the outworking of the scientific revolution. We're immersed in particular ways of thinking, analytic ways of thinking, and we want to ask how questions, scientific questions if you like. How did God do this? How long did it take? How can Jesus be God and man? But what if the Bible was not written to answer these sorts of questions? What if that was not the purpose of God or the original authors? Think about the original authors. The Bible was written thousands of years ago by people in a different time and place and culture. In fact, the Bible is made up of 66 books, each one written for different reasons by human authors inspired by God. And I'm willing to bet that not one of those human authors was interested in satisfying the questions of skeptical 21st century Westerners. This leads us to the most basic rule of all reading and interpretation. It's something you do all the time, but you might not have thought about it. The rule is, Mind your genre. Genre is a French word meaning kind or type or sort. And it's a technical word to describe forms of communication. In our case, the Bible. Now, you don't have to read much of the Bible to know that there are various types of literature in its pages, various genres. You don't read the Psalms in the same way that you read the Gospels. And the epistles are different again. Because whether you've thought about it before or not, you know that poetry is not history. And you know that Harry Potter is not a dictionary. Don't reach for Harry Potter if you want to know the definition of anti-disestablishmentarianism, which might be a relevant topic given the Queen's passing and the current debates in the Anglican Church, but we won't go there. And as I think Mike reminded us, Jesus is not a door and nor is he bread. You'd be a very confused gospel reader if you read John 10:9 and wondered whether Jesus was a door made of metal or of wood. Let me give you an example of a piece of literature. It's a piece of my own writing, actually. Matthew lies on his bed, crying his heart out. His heart is broken. Crying his heart out, his Juliet has left him. What do you make of that? It may not be the most profound piece of literature that you've heard lately, but I'm guessing that you quickly recognised that it was poetry. You did not mistake it for an engineering lecture, for example. And knowing that it was poetry helped you interpret it. You did not hear that Matt's heart was broken and start wondering if there was blood all over the bed. You knew that my masterpiece was figurative language for something else. In fact, you probably knew what the poem was about. You knew that the truth of the poem, if there were any truth in it, had nothing to do with eyes and hearts. You knew the poem was about unrequited love and the pain of broken relationships. So the lesson is this. If you don't know what sort of literature you're reading, you can't make sense of it. And when it comes to the Bible, while there are numerous sorts of literature in it, one thing is clear. The Bible is not a scientific textbook, and it doesn't aim to give us answers to what we might call scientific questions. Yes, parts of the Bible are historical, but it's never science. Now, when it comes to Genesis 1 and 2, it's about what we might call theological truth. And if we didn't know that already, then as soon as you read it and think about it carefully, we would soon pick up the clues from the text itself and also by knowing something about the cultural context. We would see that the structure of Genesis 1 and 2 is very contrived and thematic, and that trying to squeeze Genesis 1 and 2 into a chronological history is very difficult without a lot of contortions. Must we try to reconcile Genesis 1, where humankind are created last, with Genesis 2, where they're created before the trees and the shrubs? Did the author not notice this so-called discrepancy? Or perhaps we aren't meant to read these chapters as if they were giving us a chronological history of creation. And as we've already heard from Mike and Renee, knowing the cultural context of the ancient Near East helps us to see what the writer is asserting. Here, the writer is asserting something against the other creation stories of the time. There is one true God, the creator of all there is, the one who orders creation, the one who makes human beings in his own image to rule the earth, the one who is a moral God expecting the same of humankind. And if we knew Hebrew, we would also see the numerous word plays at work. We would know that Adam is not primarily someone's name. It is first man or humankind, and later it's used as a proper name. And we would know that Adam, the man, is created from Adama, the dust of the ground. And so the intricate word plays and the structuring of the creation story go on. That reminds me of the time that the famous atheist Richard Dawkins met with God and told God that humans now knew how to make a human being and that there was no need for God. God asked how that was, and Dawkins said that all you need is dust. So God said, okay, let's have a human-making competition. Dawkins agreed, and he picked up a handful of dust. No way, said God. You get your own dust. Moving on. The alert reader will also wonder about where Adam and Eve's son Cain got his wife from in chapter 4, and why Cain fears that someone will slay him, and how on earth he builds a city if he's all alone. And you might also wonder why, in fact, Adam did not die physically in the day that he ate the fruit. We could go on, but the point is this. Do we really think that the original author, Moses perhaps, was a little low on the IQ scale and just didn't notice these so-called problems? If the author wanted to tell us a harmonious chronological account that satisfied our questions, then they could have done that. So perhaps we have to recognise that the text that we have is already full of hints that it is meant to be read for another sort of truth. Very roughly, and forgive the comparison, just like my profound poetry about unrequited love, the Genesis text is about truths that lie outside the bounds of science. Question. Is this sort of explanation about reading Genesis just a response to modern science about biology and the age of the earth? Are we fiddling with the text in the light of science? No, actually, because long before science had even been dreamed of, Christian theologians warned about being sure that we paid attention to the intention of the original authors. To give one example, Augustine, one of the greatest of Christian theologians, warned in the 5th century about Genesis specifically that we should not pretend that it answers what we would now call scientific questions. In fact, Augustine says, if we Christians take Genesis to be talking science, we would be abusing the intention of the original authors, and we will look very foolish in the eyes of non-believers who do know something about the natural world. Here is a snippet of what Augustine said 1,600 years ago. Even non-Christians know something about the earth, the heavens, the motion and orbit of the stars. Now, it's a disgraceful thing for a non-believer to hear a Christian, presumably giving the meaning of Holy Scripture, talking nonsense on these topics. The shame is that people outside the household of faith think that our sacred writers held such opinions. So the idea that Genesis should be read as if it was science is a relatively new one, and that idea completely confuses the nature of science and the nature of Christian theology. In summary, let me remind you from 2 weeks ago that science searches for the mechanisms and the laws of the universe. It tries to answer how questions. It doesn't try and answer or shouldn't answer the big questions of theology or metaphysics or morality. Christianity is different. It offers answers to the big questions, but is mostly not interested in the how questions. In the words of Galileo, the Bible teaches how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. At this point, I think it's clear that science can force us to think about revising some of our previous taken-for-granted understandings of the biblical picture. But let me remind you that our traditional assumptions about the days or order of creation, perhaps, or about Adam and Eve, are not the same as doctrine. In fact, the Christian church does reconsider its assumptions and arrive at new conclusions. No, we don't rewrite the core of the gospel, but we do question traditional assumptions. For example, the church assumed that the earth was at the centre of the universe. After all, the Bible speaks about the earth not moving, and the evidence of our senses tell us that the stars and the moon revolve around the earth. Then eventually, in the light of Copernicus and Galileo, both faithful Christians, by the way, the church eventually moved its position. Assumptions about slavery changed. Assumptions about Indigenous people in Australia changed. Have you read John Harris's One Blood? I highly recommend it. Assumptions about Adam and Eve are revisited in the light of biology and genetics. Assumptions about the age of the earth are another example. Remember, none of these is a doctrinal matter. None of these has the slightest importance when it comes to putting your faith in Christ. Let me finish today with a little bit about what modern biology, including genetics, tells us. You might ask why I didn't start with the science, and the answer to that is, for Christians, the Bible is foundational. Yes, we might revisit some of our assumptions in the light of science, but the Bible comes first. So briefly, here is the currently accepted big picture that biology paints. There are lots of unknowns and lots of debate about the detail, but the consensus amongst scientists about the big picture is overwhelming. Inside every living creature, there are instructions for how that individual will grow and develop. That is the genetic code, the genome. And for reasons I won't explain, that code gets modified before it gets passed on to the next generation, whether that's the next generation of people or bananas or mice. So variation in the genetic code produces different strains or versions of a life form. Your children are not the same as you. In other words, your genetic code is different to either of your parents, and in some ways that might be useful, but in other ways that might be problematic. In the extreme, some of these modifications that happen over time mean that some organisms are able to reproduce more successfully than others. So reproductive success results in some strains or versions dying out and others living to reproduce. That's what's commonly called survival of the fittest. And to state the obvious, all the life forms that we see alive today have been successful in reproducing. In short, genes mutate, individuals are selected by the pressures of their environment, and so populations of individuals evolve. In the case of humans, our species, Homo sapiens, or anatomically modern humans, have been around for about 200,000 to 300,000 years. And in the case of Australia, for about 65,000 years. By the way, did you know that you have a 2-metre string of tightly coiled genetic code, DNA, in each one of the 50 trillion cells in your body? That's approximately 100 trillion metres, 300 times the distance to the sun and back, if you put it all together. Isn't God amazing? How do we know all this about evolution? Well, there are two lines of evidence. The first line is observation of living things and the bones that we find in the ground. We date the bones and put together a hypothetical tree of life. The other line of evidence is very new, just the last decades. We examine the DNA, the genetic material in living things, and we compare it. Again, without the details, we can track the DNA of bananas and chimps and humans and make confident guesses about the tree of life from that information. Here is a graphical representation of how the tree of life might look. At the middle bottom is the time zero for the Earth, about 4.5 billion years ago. Then a few hundred million years later, you find Luca, the last universal common ancestor of all life on the planet. And the further you move out from the centre point in any direction, the closer you move towards the present, which is at the outside of the semicircle where you find all organisms alive today. Did you know that humans share 99% of our genes with chimps and bonobos? Why? Because we have a last common ancestor with them a few million years ago. At that point, the evolutionary tree branched out. And at the tip of one branch are humans, and at the tip of another branch are chimps. No, we didn't evolve from chimps, but we do have a common ancestor a few million years ago. By the way, you also share 85% of your DNA with the mouse under your bed, and we share 50% of our DNA, our genes, with bananas. I don't have time today to deal with all the questions that might arise from what I've said so far. Yes, there are lots of questions, and perhaps in the next weeks, here after church sometime, or in our small groups, we can discuss these things. But let me finish by encouraging you to remember that science is not a conspiracy. Sarah Sweet and Jennifer Wiseman are deeply committed Christian astronomers who are convinced that the universe is around 14 billion years old. Sarah's at the University of Queensland. Jennifer's the NASA scientist in charge of the Hubble Space Telescope. Phil Batterham from Melbourne University and Francis Collins in the US, top and bottom on the right, are deeply committed Christian geneticists convinced that biological evolution is the mechanism that God used to bring about the amazing diversity of life on this planet. Mike Clark and Andrew Bennett from Melbourne are evolutionary biologists. Mike was head of life sciences at La Trobe University. These people are not fools. These people love their Bible. And these people worship the God who, in his wisdom, allows science to uncover the remarkable nature of creation. So I hope you've at least got an inkling today of what you might say to somebody who said that biology and the Bible don't mix. Just as a coin has two sides, and just as there are two causes for the boiling water, God is the primary cause of life, the universe, and everything. And in his grace, he gives us minds and curiosity to do science and uncover the secondary mechanisms behind the Creator's handiwork. May all the praise and glory be to him. I promised a book recommendation. There it is. Dennis Alexander's Creation or Evolution, Do We Have to Choose? Yes, as well, on the more general topic of science and Christianity, you can allow me to spruik my own book. It's an easy read and it has lots of pictures. And don't forget to watch Ford versus Ferrari. Not necessarily for edification, but it's a great story, a great movie. And also to read John Harris's masterpiece about Christianity and Indigenous contact in Australia. It is edifying and a story we ought to know. It's called One Blood. May God grant us wisdom and faith as we ponder these things and encourage others to do the same. Amen.